Good evening and welcome to the Ithaca College Forum on the Privatization of Prisons and Sodexo Marriott Services' Relationship to Private Prisons. I'm pleased to see so many of you here this evening. We're all here to listen and to learn about these issues. As most of you know, we organize this forum for the benefit of the campus community in order to gain a deeper understanding of the issues associated with the privatization of prisons, as well as the relationship of the college's food service provider, Sodexo Marriott Services, to private prisons. Representatives of the Ithaca College chapter of the Young Democratic Socialists worked with us to organize this event, and I want to acknowledge that at this time. A bit of background on why we're here. Late in the fall, members of the Ithaca College chapter of YDS demanded that Ithaca College end its contract with Sodexo Marriott Services as its food service provider. In December, I agreed with representatives of YDS that the college would sponsor tonight's forum as an educational opportunity for the college community. This evening, we will hear from representatives from the Prison Moratorium Project and Sodexo Marriott Services. We will also hear from an expert in the criminal justice system with significant professional and scholarly experience, Dr. Michael Jacobson, Professor of Criminal Justice at John Jay College of the City University of New York. He will be here also to lend his perspective and knowledge to these issues. Shortly, our moderator will introduce our guest panelists and provide us with the agreed-upon ground rules for this evening's forum. I'm hopeful that during the next 90 minutes, we will have the opportunity to listen to various perspectives and to participate in dialogue that is informative, challenging, and respectful. I would now like to introduce our moderator for tonight's forum, David Speller, Assistant Director for Multicultural Affairs, and also to thank him in advance for the important role that he is serving in this evening. David?
You know, tonight we've got a unique opportunity. Tonight we get to share one of the oldest and purest traditions of a college or a university. That's the receiving and giving of knowledge. Tonight, within this safe environment, we get to exchange ideas and opinions. We get the opportunity to be informed and informed. We get the opportunity to listen as well as to be heard. Within this safe environment, we can agree or disagree with calmness or with great passion. And we get to do all of these things without fear or retribution or retaliation. However, we do have to pay a price for these freedoms of expression tonight. Some simple rules, which if respected and followed, will allow all of the above freedoms of speech and expressions to safely happen. My job is a pretty simple one. My role is to share these rules with you and to see that we all continue to honor them throughout the evening. First of all, you need to understand that the rules tonight were agreed upon by YDS and the college in hopes of having a very enlightening evening. So it's important that you understand that, that both groups sat down around the table and agreed to the following rules. This will be the format for this evening. Our three panelists will be permitted to make some opening remarks. Each panelist will be given approximately 10 minutes for their presentation. My job will be to monitor those minutes. Following the panel presentations, we'll have a question and answer period for 25 minutes. Now you see microphones strategically planted in the middle of the aisles. What you'll do at that point, and we'll go over those rules again after the panelists have finished, is you'll quietly stand up to a mic and I'll acknowledge and give you a chance to speak. Now I'll be timing you too in this question and answer period, and I'll try to keep that dialogue within a 2 to 3 minute conversation. The last segment of the program, and again we'll review all of this after the panelists talk, is we're going to have a chance for some common statements and some more question and answers. So if you simply have something that you need to say, this will be your opportunity to say it. Now again, I warn you ahead of time that in fairness to everybody, we keep those comments if we can to a minimum of 2 to 3 minutes. And again, I'll be the timekeeper for that as well. So if we can follow these rules, I think we'll have a good productive evening. Okay? Let me introduce the panelists. Kevin Prentice, welcome. The Centrally Isolated Victim. Kevin is chairman of the board of the Prisons Moratorium Project. an organization formed in 1995 to educate the public about criminal justice issues and to give youth and communities a greater voice in criminal justice debates. Again, welcome, Kip. Bob Stern is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Sodexo Marriott Services, the food service provider for Ithaca College. Mr. Stern graduated from Oberlin College in 1980. He's at the end, by the way. And earned his law degree in 1983. Michael Jacobson, Professor of Criminal Justice at John Jay College, and the President introduced you to Michael. Gentlemen, are you ready? At this time, we're going to turn it over to Kevin Prince.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. It's a pleasure to be here tonight at Ithaca College. The last time I came under very different circumstances, there were students who had organized a protest and taken over a financial aid office. And it's exciting to be here tonight. It's exciting to see so much interest in this issue. I feel powerfully about this issue. I've been working around criminal justice issues and with student activists for a number of years. I am what Sodexo Marriott calls a professional activist, and that's true. That is, this is a full-time job for me. Most of the people working in the campaign aren't, but it takes a full-time sort of person to do some of the research and background stuff and prepare literature and work those hours. So to give students a chance to get involved in issues that they care about. Some of you, I think I know a lot of you in the audience tonight, so people in the audience know how many people roughly are in prisons and jails in the U.S. today?
2 million.
That's right. There's 2 million people in prison and jail. To give you some perspective, anyone know how many people in the world are in prison and jail, roughly?
8 million.
8 million, right? So we have a quarter of the world's prisoners and approximately 5% of the world's prison population. The highest, I've heard different figures, we have the highest rate of incarceration in the industrialized world, higher than China. I've heard higher than South Africa under apartheid. Extraordinarily high incarceration rate. And so the surprise for us then is if we lock up so many people, and presumably the purpose of locking up these people is to make us all feel safer, we find it odd. You know, and if I ask, you know, and to give it a sense, anyone know how many people we had in prison in 1970?
500,000?
300,000, actually. So we've gone from about 300,000 people in prison and jail to 2 million people in prison and jail, 6.5 times as many people. So the question is, does anyone in the audience think that we are 6.5 times safer today than we were 30 years ago? Take the silence as a no. In fact, I think that from the people we talk to, the experiences, most people feel less safe today, think they are less safe today than they were 30 years ago. And I think this is evidence that the current criminal justice policies are a disaster. I think a lot of people in the room would agree with this. I think a lot of folks at Sodexo Marriott might agree that the policy is a disaster, and that's not the primary thing we're here to debate. But I think it should give people a sense of the gravity of the situation. Of those 2 million people in prison and jail, more than half are African American. And I think it's unfortunate that the three of us up here are white males, because it's not white males who this is happening to predominantly, right? You're looking at communities where one in every three young African-American males is currently under the control of the criminal justice system, right? A virtual holocaust in communities where they're being destabilized by people being run through the prison system. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. Fear of crime is a reason. The growing dependence of rural economies, particularly upstate New York. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the fact that, you know, upstate New York has lost, you know, Smith family farms, and manufacturing is now dependent on prisons, in this case public prisons. But increasingly, for-profit corporations have a role in determining our criminal justice policy, and that role is a dangerous one. In particular, I want to talk about the for-profit private prison industry. A lot of people, certainly before this came up, were unaware that prisons can be operated as a business for profit. And it's contracted out. A private prison operates a little bit like a contracted out food service. That is, the state decides that they will select from a number of bidders, right, for who's going to operate a private prison. I'll tell you a story of one of these companies, Corrections Corporation of America, the largest private prison company in the world, started in Nashville, Tennessee. They have deep roots in Nashville. A couple of times they've tried to take over the entire Tennessee state system. And a lot of people think that if there are private prisons, they get contracts because maybe they're cheaper, maybe they're more efficient, you know, they provide better services. Much of the arguments that are used for private food service companies coming in and taking over food services. Now, There may be some disagreement on this. Many of the students I talk to don't think that their food, you know, that they get from Sodexo or Marriott or Aramark or Compass is particularly cheap. Many people don't think that it's really good, right? It's food, you know, and people survive, and that's fine. But private prisons, you know, operate under this assumption that they're going to be cheaper and better. The reality is that all the research shows no conclusive evidence that they save money. On the other hand, they do terrible things to the people who are imprisoned in them and the people who work in them. I'll tell you a couple stories. One is a story of a man named Anthony Bowman. Now, Anthony Bowman is from Tennessee, and he was sentenced to a CCA prison in Tennessee. And CCA was having a problem. They weren't making enough profit because the whole point of Corrections Corporation of America is to make money for their shareholders. Because they weren't making enough profit, they started to look to cut costs. And CCA has lots of ways to cut costs. They cut down on staffing. They hire very low-paid guards. They skimp on training. They don't do programs. They don't fix the locks on their doors a lot of times. They don't give walkie-talkies to the people who guard the prisons, and that results in lots of violence and problems in those prisons at a much higher rate than public prisons. Another thing that these companies do is they cut medical care. And CCA had a bright idea, and they said, we're going to give the doctor an incentive contract to cut costs for medical care. We're going to give them an incentive, but right now we're paying $3.60 approximately per person per day. We would like the doctor to cut that down to $2.60 per person per day. That's a huge savings. And so what they offered the doctor was that they would double his salary if he could cut the cost from $3.60 to $2.60. Double his salary. So from $100,000 to $200,000 a year. If he did not achieve savings, they were going to cut his salary by 30%. So this is a doctor who's going to earn $70,000 next year or $200,000 next year. And the decision is going to be based on how much treatment he gives to sick prisoners. So it's no surprise that the doctor made $200,000 the next year because he brought costs down to $240,000. The next year, he brought costs down below a dollar. So this was an incredibly innovative and successful plan when it came to saving money. What it wasn't good at was maintaining the health of people who had no other recourse. Anthony Bowman suffered from sickle cell anemia, had a long history of health problems. His mother saw him, and he was near dead, and she got him transferred to a public hospital. The reason that he died in the public hospital, the reason he died was that for pneumonia that he had, he'd been given painkillers. Right, he'd been given painkillers, not sent to a doctor, not sent to a hospital, not given medicine, given painkillers because a doctor wanted to save money. He died, and what sort of crime do you think that he'd committed to die in a CCA prison, right? Not murder, not rape, not even drug dealing. It was for bounced checks, right? So he got a CCA death sentence for bounced checks. Now, who was sitting on the board of Corrections Corporation of America when they came up with this innovative policy? Right, a guy by the name of Jean-Pierre Cuny. Jean-Pierre Cuny is an executive with a company called Sodexo Alliance. Sodexo Alliance is the largest food service catering company in the world with operations in about 70 countries, and their operations in this country are called Sodexo Marriott Services. This is the magazine of Sodexo Alliance. The magazine of Sodexo Alliance, which one of our activists found on a coffee table of a Sodexo Marriott office. In this magazine, it talks about the new clients of Sodexo Alliance, the worldwide conglomerate, and it lists among them clients of Sodexo Marriott Services, new contracts at St. Catherine's College, Georgia Power in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a multinational company that controls and operates and owns and will soon own 100% of your food service company. And that means that right now 48 cents of every dollar you spend goes to a corrupt private prison company, right? Not only that, but Sodexo Marriott Services, unfortunately, also donates money to an extreme right-wing think tank called the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're listed on its website. They're a member. They gave at least $25,000 in 1999. They promote anti-affirmative action policies, anti-environmental policies, privatization, and private prison building. I think it's a problem that students are contributing to these causes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn the attention to Bob Stern, please.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank Ithaca College as well for this great opportunity to be heard. I can't say that I'm an expert in criminal justice. I'm not. I'm here as a representative of a food service company. What I can talk about are the connections that Mr. Prentice just alluded to between our company and CCA, Corrections Corporation of America. Sodexo Merit has great respect for the rights of students anywhere to express their views on important social issues such as this. And we welcome students evaluating a college's contractor, such as us, on all the activities that we're engaged in. We only ask that the students look past some of the rhetoric and look to the facts, make an informed decision. So why did the company send a lawyer from headquarters to talk about this? Mainly because our businessmen and women are out serving food, providing college food service, patient health care services. They're not to be distracted by talking about a business that we're not really in. By way of introduction, Sodexo Merit Services is a food service company that provides food and some facilities management services to colleges, hospitals, businesses, and schools in the United States and Canada. We're a separate New York Stock Exchange company. We don't own, we don't operate prisons anywhere. We are 48% owned by Sodexo Alliance, which has similar operations in about 70 countries around the world. Now, there's been a lot of talk about how much of student dollars are going into Corrections Corporation of America. Let me be very clear about the answer. There is no money going from a student's dollar into CCA. Before 1998, when Sodexo Merit was first formed, several years before that, Sodexo Alliance made its investment in CCA. Since the formation of our company, which was 1998, they've not put any additional cash into CCA to buy more stock. Just because it owns some of the stock doesn't mean that they're investing in the company on an ongoing basis. In fact, recently, Sodexo Alliance publicly stated its intent to sell its entire shares of CCA. Given that, it seems that Sodexo Alliance is not investing further dollars in CCA. I want to explain just a little bit about how the food service contract between Sodexo Merit and Ithaca College works. We have a contract where the sales, that's the board plans, the fees you pay, and what you pay to cash register, those sales belong to Ithaca College, not to Sodexo Merit Services. We are simply paid a fee for managing the food service program. The costs, food, et cetera, are then reimbursed by the college. That fee for Sodexo Merit, what we make, works out to be less than 1 cent for every dollar spent by a student. So that's how the money comes from students' pockets into Sodexo Merit. Does it then go to Sodexo Alliance? Let's look at that next step. Well, Sodexo Alliance does own 48% of Sodexo Merit. That doesn't mean they can come in and take money from our bank accounts. We have other shareholders, and we spend a lot of our profits to reinvest in our businesses. What we do pay in cash to Sodexo Alliance are fees for certain services, trademark agreements, and other services. Those fees altogether amount to less than 0.5% of the sales of Sodexo Marriott that go to Sodexo Alliance. Sales and revenue are the same thing. So what is Sodexo Alliance's involvement in prisons? There is a proposal by Sodexo Alliance to buy the rest of Sodexo Marriott. So given that, which is a recent development, it's more appropriate now for us to talk about Sodexo Alliance's activities. Sodexo Alliance has a mission statement, which is to improve the quality of life for people. In the late 1980s, the French government asked Sodexo for help in improving the quality of life in French prisons, which at that time were fairly bad. Sodexo had the initial contract and has won praise in France for its positive impact on prison conditions there, including innovative work training programs for inmates. I want to stress only 1% of all of Sodexo Alliance's business is in prisons. 99% of their other businesses are food service at businesses and schools and colleges and hospitals. Sodexo Alliance also manages prisons in the United Kingdom and Australia, where it did recently buy out CCA's interest in joint ventures there. And that deal had the effect of severing the relationships between Sodexo Alliance and CCA in those countries. So let's look at what Sodexo Alliance's record is in this area. In the UK, Sodexo Alliance has been praised for its prison management. And I have quotes here, which in the interest of time, I think I'll skip, but basically praising their training programs in the UK. And this was from the Chief Inspector of Prisons in the UK. A number of former inmates are now working in food service accounts for Sodexo Alliance. Terminating the contract with Ithaca College won't do a thing to change the way legislators decide to manage prisons or the way judges sentence prisoners. I said earlier I welcome students reviewing what a college contractor does. Here's what we do. We're one of the largest donors of food to America's Second Harvest in the country, a leading hunger relief organization. Thousands of our employees actively work in homeless shelters and other charitable efforts, primarily around ending hunger. We've created the Sodexo Foundation, which has a mission of supporting efforts to fight hunger in the United States. And just to sum up in conclusion, you know, I'm extremely proud to work with Sodexo. We're a company with the highest standards of integrity. We treat people well. And you can say what you want about the quality of our food service. After all, you are our customers. But we sincerely do hope that we provide those services in a way which does improve the quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Michael Jacobson, I turn the mic over to you.
Good evening. I'm going to talk really, really fast and try to at least, I thought what might make the most sense, since I'm clearly not immersed in the details of Sodexo Marriott or what's happening on campus, but I thought what I'd try to do is give folks a sense, and I know some of you already have a good sense of this, but of the context in which correctional policy making is made, what some of the more recent correctional history is in this country, and how privatization and the movement of privatization fits into that context. As Kevin accurately said, we are the most incarcerative country on earth. We put a higher percentage of our population in prison than any other country. We put an incredibly disproportionate numbers, as Kevin also said, of minorities in prison as well. The rough figures are that for every 350 or so whites per 100,000 that are in prison in this country, there are about 32 or 3,300 African Americans. That's characterized our correctional system for an incredibly long time. And in fact, the growth of corrections in this country, which has been the hallmark essentially of our criminal justice policy, is symbolic of the fastest growing function of government, state by state. No other function of government over the last two decades has grown at the rate that corrections has. Not health, not education, not transportation, not environmental protection. Nothing can match corrections for the sheer percentage increase, both in the number of people and in the money we spend in corrections. So in that context, it's not particularly surprising that a privatization movement, business of privatization came about. When business people were looking at this trend in the mid-80s, what they saw was an almost insatiable appetite on the part of policymakers to build prisons, spend an incredible amount of money on prisons, and that was an environment that, from a purely financial basis, regardless of what you think about private prisons, was ripe for the advent of private prisons. And what's happened in private prisons, although private prisons make up only a fraction of the total number of the 2 million people who are incarcerated in jails and prisons, the current number there's some debate about, but it's probably somewhere in the area of 120 or 125,000 of this country's 2 million people are in private prisons. So while it's a relatively small percent, about 6 to 8%, the rate of growth of private prisons has dwarfed even the rate of growth of public prisons. So while public prisons have grown by about anywhere from 6 to 8% a year over the last 10 years, private prisons have grown at anywhere from 5 to 8 times that. It's a growth industry. In the late 80s and early to mid 90s, private prisons were the most successful performers on the stock market. If you had invested a lot of money in private prisons in the mid 80s, you'd be a very rich person, at least as of 2 or 3 years ago. They've taken a real dive, and I should spend a minute talking about that. But before I do, it's important to understand the context in which these kinds of correctional decisions are made. Criminal justice policy making, correctional policy making in this country is made on the basis of pure and almost raw emotion. We make decisions based on horrible, high-profile crimes, on fear of crimes, and the form that that policy is taken in this country is incarceration. That's what we do, bigger than any place else on earth. A couple of words about private prisons themselves. Kevin alluded to this. Private prisons, like the rest of criminal justice and correctional policy making, is something that people have very strong feelings about. You don't have to be an expert to think that they make sense, they don't make sense, they're efficient, they're not efficient. Let me say two words about the research itself. While the research is dominated primarily by people who have specific points of view, either for or against privatization, the bulk of the sort of the accepted research in the field, which I won't bore you with at the moment, essentially says that there's no case to be made that private prisons are either cheaper or better run than public prisons. There's a general consensus that that is the case. But the reality of the matter is that's not why states privatize. States privatize because they have overcrowded public prison systems, because they are under consent orders to find more space for prisons. And one of the things that private prisons do, that the introduction of private capital into what is essentially, has been for years, a public policy, has been to allow state officials to make relatively easy solutions to very complicated problems. That is, to just use private prisons instead of grappling with the tougher issues of sentencing reform, parole reform, and alternatives to incarceration. Right, one of the issues with private prison that you have to think about is not just the high-profile incidents that happen in private prisons that have been well documented. A lot of you are very familiar with them, because the fact of the matter is the public prison system does not have a particularly glorious history itself either. Those incidents happen in public prisons as well, and you don't want to put yourself in a position of being an apologist for public prisons because you happen to be against private prisons. I think it's important to think about this as one large conceptual issue of correctional policy, and to think long and hard about both what the sort of philosophical and moral stance is on private companies performing what has been for years considered a state function, and more importantly, in some ways, what the introduction of private business, private capital, does to the already strain to increase incarceration ever further in this country. It's important to get away a little from the individual specific events and start putting the privatization debate in a larger correctional context. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Now we come to the part of our program which directly involves you, the audience. And the success or non-success of this will depend heavily on you as well. Let me review or go over some of the rules as we move to this part of the Q&A question and answer segment. Each person will be allowed to ask one question. You can ask that question to all the panelists, or you can direct it to one particular panelist. That panelist will answer you, with the other two panelists having a right, if they would like to also give an answer. You will be given an opportunity then, after you've gotten your answer, to ask one more question if you need to. My job is going to be to try to keep this engagement at a 2 to 3 minute clip per person. We will go left to right. There are three microphones sitting out there. And as soon as I see somebody step up to those microphones, we'll begin. What I'd like you to do is tell your name, let us know who you are. One other small piece I have to give you: we really would encourage the Ithaca College community to step up to the mic. All those from the community at large, clearly we will have an opportunity to take your questions, but I think as this thing was advertised, we specifically wanted to give the Ithaca College community to be heard first. Please.
Okay, my name is Sammy Kahn. I'm a sophomore, and I'm a member of YDS. And I just found it interesting to note that you said you knew, Robertson, you knew nothing about the criminal justice system, then 2 seconds later you admitted that you're a lawyer. So.
Who are you directing this question to, Sam?
Robertson.
Okay.
Here's the question. On Sodexo Merit's website, it states that the company doesn't have a position or control over its shareholders, and it doesn't have a position on issues that don't directly affect the company. My question is this. What if one of Merit's investors has shares in, say, or one of their investors was profiting from the dictatorship in Burma, or say, South Africa during apartheid? Would you then have no position? I mean, just because the profits are minimal doesn't make it right.
A couple comments. First, anybody can buy stock in Sodexo Merit. We're a public company, and we can't control who buys our shares. To your point, if somebody was engaged in some activity that we thought was really morally offensive and heinous, then we'd probably speak out about that. To have a comment on showing that we don't approve of that as a person that's invested in us. With Sodexo Alliance, we've not seen any evidence that the way they've acted in the prison market is morally offensive or heinous to that kind of degree. They have a good record and a good reputation in that line of business.
So what your customers...
Time, Sammy, just 1 minute. Would anybody else like to respond to that?
Yeah.
Hold on, Sam, I'll be right with you. Go ahead.
Okay. 2 points on this. One is that I think, in theory, it's possible for anyone to buy stock in Sodexo Marriott. In fact, everyone in the financial community knows perfectly well that it operates as a subsidiary of Sodexo Alliance and that Sodexo Alliance completely controls Sodexo Marriott. This is a report by Merrill Lynch analyzing Sodexo Marriott, which refers to it as the U.S. subsidiary Sodexo Marriott Services, in referring to Sodexo Alliance, and goes on to explain how 52% of Sodexo Alliance's worldwide revenues come from Sodexo Marriott Services. As much as I appreciate our colleague from Sodexo Marriott's information about the company, I trust Merrill Lynch more than I trust their PR strategy to talk about what the company really is. Everyone in the financial community knows that it is part of Sodexo Alliance, not a separate, independently traded company, which it won't be by April anyway.
Thank you, Kevin. Okay, you have one more question you can ask, Sam, okay?
You said that what Sodexo Marriott views doesn't view anything improper in Sodexo Alliance or its investments. But what about your customers, or what about the students here? Does that not matter? Are our morals dictated by the way Sodexo Marriott does its business and its bottom line? Thanks.
Your thoughts do matter, and that's why we're here tonight. And I think it's great to have an open discussion about it, because your thoughts are important. However, if we look to our customers, where we have millions of people eating our meals every year, for consensus on every decision or activity, there'd be such a diversity of opinion among customers, we would never be able to make any decisions. And again, we in Sodexo Marriott are not in the prison business. And to respond to the point from a minute ago, we are a separate company. We do have a separate board of directors that is responsible for managing our company. And we do have a 48% shareholder. Under French accounting law, since they own more than 40%, they consider us a subsidiary in their perspective, and so both of those perspectives are right.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Bob. Yes, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is James Baker. My question is primarily for Bob Stern, but if Kevin Prentice has info on this from Merrill Lynch, that'll be great too. My question is, how many countries in which CCA operates does Sodexo Marriott still have ties with? You've said they've cut their ties with CCA in multiple countries. Is the U.S. the only country remaining? If not, which others remain? And what are their plans concerning ties with this corporation? And if their plans are to sever ties with the corporation, how long is that going to take, and what's the holdup?
Two ways to sort of go after that. I'm sorry for the complication, but we are in the situation where we have a 48% shareholder. Sodexo Marriott has no ties to CCA. Sodexo Alliance, as far as I know, their ties internationally were only in the UK and Australia, where they bought out CCA's interest, mm-hmm. plus the stock that they still own at CCA. So having made the public announcement of their intention to sell the stock of CCA and having separated themselves from CCA and those other two countries, it seems to me that that's the only involvement left is owning the shares.
that I'm aware of.
You want to say something to that?
Yeah, absolutely. What I think, I mean, that's essentially accurate, that Sodexo Alliance, but I take a different twist on it. What's happened is, you know, we're talking about how no new investments have been made in CCA since Sodexo Marriott was created. That's because they're investing in prison privatization all around the world. They used to be just a private prison investor. Now Sodexo Alliance directly owns and operates 3,100 beds, where in Australia we have evidence of similar abuses to CCA facilities. So, you know, when we started this campaign, they were just an investor. Now they're a private prison company.
One more question, please.
For clarification, Bob Stern, what are the Sodexo Alliance's plans concerning its ties with CCA in the United States? And are you saying that, Mr. Prentice, that the Sodexo Alliance has ties with other private prison corporations, essentially?
Okay, let's start with a quick answer here, and then we'll go there. Fair enough?
Sure. The Sodexo Alliance's ties are that it has 100% ownership of UK Detention Services and Corrections Corporation of Australia. In regard to the CCA, I mean, they also, a point about the divestment from CCA, it's talked about as if they had always been planning to divest from CCA, when our original conversation that we had with their representatives of Sodexo Alliance, they had no interest in divestment. The interest in divestment came, so the supposed plans to divest came only after students had taken action. I think that's an important thing for people to recognize. It was students who made that happen, not the company's decision.
Bob, do you need your part of the question repeated?
No, it's okay.
Okay, please.
In terms of their plans, as they have stated publicly, they plan to sell their interest in CCA. In terms of their other operations, again, 1% of Sodexo Alliance's business worldwide involves prisons. The majority of that 1% is merely providing food service to prisoners.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, my name is Kia Kozin, and as of last semester, I was a student here, so I'm still part of the community.
Your name again is?
Kia Kozin.
Kia Kozin. Okay, Kia.
Hi. I was just wondering if this question is for all three gentlemen, and that is if you could perhaps comment a little bit about your personal and your professional opinions about an industry in the United States and around the world, as Kevin was talking about, that is becoming increasingly privatized, and how I'm just wondering, Mr. Jacob, your last name I can't see.
Mr. Jacobson?
Jacobson, sorry. And also, since you do research about this and that type of thing, like your opinion on how the industry used to be more of a public one, like people weren't making a direct profit on it, there weren't shareholders in it and that type of thing. There's certainly profit being made. It was supposedly being recycled back into it to support the system itself, and how that's completely changed, and now we incarcerate people and make a profit from it. And if you could just comment on that, and also if you have a perspective that's a professional one and that type of thing.
Let me give a little direction to this. What's the first question again?
Well, I just want some, like, this isn't a question. This is just like, I want some feedback about what you guys think about the fact that we've turned an industry incarcerating people into a private making industry where it's motivated by profit. And I'm wondering from all three gentlemen, not just Kevin's perspective, Mr. Stern's also, what you think about that.
Gotcha. Why don't we go left to right, gentlemen? Please.
Okay. Personally, my gut feeling, and again, I don't profess to be an expert in privatized prison management, but my gut feeling is that it's like any other business, which means that there are some companies that are not very good at it, and that there are some companies that are probably very good at it, and that given everybody's experience in dealing with state government agencies, whether it's a division of motor vehicles or whatever it is, that I certainly would think that in some areas, private companies can run things better than the government. And if it's a well-run program, I don't see that it couldn't add value to both the state and the prisoners if it's well done.
Okay. Yeah, I have a somewhat different take on this. One of the things that concerns me most, more so than the sort of privatization, not privatization issue, is the amount of incarceration we do. And given the structural tendency to incarcerate more and more people, my biggest concern about private incarceration is less about the individual abuses that there are certainly tons of that you can recite with great accuracy. And it's not that I'm not concerned about that, it's just that those abuses happen in public prisons probably to a greater extent, again, just because of the numbers, than private prisons. my concern with private prisons is twofold. One is I have great concerns that as a function of government, because running a total institution, a prison, gives you more control over people's lives than almost any other thing government does, that to me, just on a philosophical basis, is an area of responsibility that belongs with the state. And I say that with the proviso that this is not a function that the state has performed with particular alacrity, right? The state has real problems delivering this service. So I mean, I always want to say that. I don't want to get into the position of being critical of privatization and giving the state systems a free ride. They're not that different to me in on an operational level. My other real practical problem with privatization is that introducing private capital into this business, which already has a tendency to incarcerate more and more people, will simply ratchet up the pressure to incarcerate even more people, because that's what private business wants, right? They want more market share. We already have enough tendency to incarcerate people. We have powerful correction unions. We have tough on crime legislators. We have businesses that surround the building of prisons now. So to introduce sort of sophisticated private business in whose interest it is to incarcerate even more and more people is far more a concern to me than sort of trying to evaluate who runs a better prison. It's the introduction of private business in the first place that's my primary concern.
The global revenues of Sodexo Alliance are about $6 billion, and according to Merrill Lynch, half of that comes from Sodexo Marriott Services.
Okay, hold on. You care to respond to that? Because you have an opportunity to do that.
No.
Okay, go.
So I take that as fact. So I guess my second question is, how would that bottom line be affected by the National Labor Relations Board that your company signed off on about, or settlement that your company signed on a few years ago? I know that you had problems with your labor unions and things like that. You were restricting their growth, and I believe I read somewhere that there was a whole chapter in Sodexo Marriott's manual on how to deal with unions, whatever that means. So how did that Labor Relations Board settlement affect your bottom line?
Are you directing at the Bob?
Yes.
Okay.
Very clearly, there's a clear answer to the question. The bottom line effect to Sodexo Marriott was zero in terms of dollars, which is what most people refer to as the bottom line. Let me correct some misperceptions about what that settlement was. We have an employee handbook, like any company, with lots of policies. There were two policies that a labor union raised objections to. The policies were, first, that we required our employees to keep our material information, keep our proprietary information confidential. The second was that we did not want our employees to come back to the work sites after the closing of their shift. That's because our work sites are not our plants or our factories. They're our clients' property, like this college. Those policies are never intended to discourage employees from talking about their wages or unionizing. And we did agree to clarify those policies to make it clear that they were not intended to discourage union organizing. We respect the rights of our employees to decide among themselves if they wish to organize a union or not.
Any panelists want to respond to that? You have a minute. Please.
Yeah, actually, Sodexo Marriott is notorious for anti-union, anti-worker policies. In fact, this agreement with the National Labor Relations Board over the illegal work rules, the National Labor Relations Board, as I hear it, recently found that they were in violation of a promise to post signs about workers' rights and are now required to do it in cafeterias again. But it's an old story. Looking at this campaign at State University of New York at Albany, they fought a union there until finally they were kicked out after lots of student pressure. Now the workers have a union and they have a little better wages than they had under Sodexo Marriott.
Thank you. Please.
Yeah, my name is Kenneth Froberg. My question is for Dr. Jacobson. As a neutral party, I'd like to, just for clarification, exactly how do these private prisons go about making a profit?
Well, there are a couple of ways, but the bottom line is the way you make a profit through private prisons, because prisons as institutions are essentially incredibly labor intensive, even with all the technological innovations that have happened over the last several years, prisons are still the main expense of any prison is going to be its staff. So the way they try to make money, they're not always successful, is to house people at a cheaper, what's called a per diem, at a cheaper rate per day. And they do that essentially by having institutions that usually have fairly well-paid managers because they're very sophisticated companies. They usually try to get experienced wardens and deputy wardens, but the correction officers themselves, they are usually paid less than state correction officers. Their benefit packages are usually somewhat less, and they private prisons, for the most part, work in non-union states, so the staffs are almost always non-union. So to the extent they can save on labor, that's really where they try to make their money. Private prisons will also say that because they're in the private sector and they're not hampered by bureaucratic purchasing rules and civil service laws and everything that goes with a lumbering bureaucracy, they can also make some savings there. But primarily, the way they make their money is by keeping their payroll below, on average, what states pay.
Second question.
And are they subject to the same regulations and by the government as the government-run prisons?
In theory, yes. In practice, incredibly difficult. The fact is, the prisoners themselves, even if they're housed, let's say, in a CCA or Wackenhut facility, are still the responsibility of the state that they're prisoners in. So they have all the rights that any state has in a public facility. The problem, the practical issue in this field has been one of monitoring what happens in those private facilities. It becomes incredibly expensive for state systems to monitor what happens in the private facilities they contract with. And since at least one of the stated goals of privatization, whether it's true or not, is to save money, it's very difficult for a state prison system to say, as part of their contract, they're going to hire 25 correction officers to go live in a private prison to watch what happens there. So a lot of the abuses that do happen in private prisons, and I have to add, they happen in public prisons too, happen because of a tremendous lack of oversight on the part of public prisons. So they do have all the rights that any prisoners do in a state. Again, in theory, in practice, it has not always worked out that way.
Right, and but the prisoners in the government-run facilities don't always get those rights either, so.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Hold on. Yes, you wanted to.
Just wanted to give an example to illustrate Michael's point. In Youngstown, Ohio, there was a prison run by Corrections Corporation of America that housed D.C. prisoners, and D.C., I mean, part of the problem is that D.C. just wasn't paying attention to what was happening in Youngstown, all sorts of disasters. The state of Ohio, a legislator tried to go to that prison to find out about rumors they heard about violence, misclassifications, and problems, and when he got to the door, he was told, go away, this is private property, you have no rights here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Please.
My name is David Unger. This question is for Mr. Stern. You talked in your opening about pride for working, that you have pride working for Sodexo Marriott. Well, I think most of the people in this audience would question pride in working for any company that has an institutional relationship in making profits off of incarceration. This is actually going to deal more back with Sodexo Marriott's labor practices. Do you feel pride in working for a company that actively does fight, despite your claims, unionization at all of its facilities, that at college campuses across the country uses captive audience meetings, anti-union videos, and uses its frontline staff to actively intimidate and coerce workers against joining unions? Do you feel pride in working for a corporation that essentially doesn't allow its workers its constitutional right to their freedom of association?
I do feel pride in working with Sodexo Marriott because we don't do those things. And if you've got the specifics, I'd be glad to talk to you about it afterwards because as the top lawyer for the company, I will not allow our employees to be intimidated if they are attempting to organize a union. And that is our policy, is that we recognize the rights of our employees to organize or not. We have about 240 accounts around the country where we are working with collective bargaining agreements. And we should not be doing anything that is intimidating employees from exercising those rights.
David, do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk to you later, but I sort of fear retribution against workers. Because it's happened in the past all over that anytime you talk to corporate reps about specific examples where workers have come forward and said the supervisors have intimidated them, that it really doesn't end up well for the worker.
Let me say this. We are a company with over 100,000 employees. We're a service business, and we won't be providing good service to our customers if we abuse and don't treat our employees well. Now, with that many employees, I can't say that there's never been an error or somebody who's done something they shouldn't. We're humans, and we're fallible. But if we're aware of it, we'll correct it, because we are serious about protecting the rights of our employees.
Kevin, you want to respond to that question?
Yeah, absolutely. Albany, I mean, you don't have to look far. Just as far as Albany, New York, where there were, you know, a consistent pattern of worker rights violations, people told to take off union buttons, right? All sorts of, you know, intimidation tactics were used at Albany, eventually unsuccessfully, but again, partly because of students and workers coming together.
We've got 5 minutes left in our Q&A session. Let's continue. Please.
Hi, my name is Aicha, and this is for the panel, but especially for Bob Stern, because I was a little confused by your introduction. There you suggested that Sodexo Alliance was praised all over the world for prison management and for increasing the quality of life. I have only one question. Who was Sodexo Alliance praised by, and whose quality of life did it increase? Thank you.
From what I've read, and the material I was looking at was from the chief inspector of prisons in the United Kingdom, who had prepared a report on Sodexo Alliance's operations based on an unannounced audit. And you know, my view, which is fairly recent to trying to learn what Sodexo Alliance's operations are in this area, is influenced by the fact that they've got strong policies where in every contract where they manage a prison service, they provide vocational training to the inmates, and they've hired a number of the inmates that have gone through those training programs.
Please.
My name is Ryan Prosser, and before I can ask my question, I need a clarification from Kevin. Approximately how many college campuses or other institutions that receive services from Sodexo Marriott are currently or have previously had campaigns against the service based on its connection with CCA?
There's around 50 campuses where there are students active. I mean, their level of activity varies from, you know, a very small group of students to, you know, sort of major stuff like having Ithaca and other places, but there's about 50 or so far in the first year of the campaign.
Okay, so my question is for Bob Stern. You mentioned through both your introduction and answering questions how important customers were to Sodexo Marriott, and Sammy asked a question earlier in which you responded that because of the millions of customers that Sodexo Marriott provides for on a yearly basis, you can't possibly poll all of these customers to find out and to use that information to make your decisions. My question for you is, how many of your customers or these so-called customers have to be screaming no before Sodexo Marriott listens?
Well, hopefully we're listening now, and that's part of why I'm here tonight.
Okay, I see we have. Yes.
Respond to that. The one complication here, I think, but to understand the relations of power here, the actual customer of Sodexo Marriott is not students. You don't wake up one morning and say, "I'm going to eat Sodexo today." Somebody chooses that you're going to eat Sodexo today, right? In fact, most people are on required meal plans. So the customers of Sodexo Marriott are college administrations. And it is when college administrations make clear to Sodexo Marriott that it is not, and Sodexo Alliance, that it is no longer appropriate to be involved in private prisons, that's when you're going to see Sodexo Alliance get out of the business. And students' role is to convince administrations of that, right? Because you don't choose, you can't just walk across the street and say, "I'm tired of investing in private prisons. I'm going to eat at a different thing on my campus." There is nothing on your campus but Sodexo, because that's the way the contracts are negotiated.
Thank you. We have. We have five more people that I see standing. My goal is to get through all five before we move into the comments portion of our program. So, where I lost my track. Let me start, let me go here. And I apologize if you were next, you'll go next, okay? Okay, please.
Hi, my name is Maureen Devine. I have a question for Bob Stern, mostly for clarification. You had mentioned a couple times about plans for stock to be sold off between Sodexo Alliance and Sodexo Marriott, correct?
What I mentioned was Sodexo Alliance has announced its intent to sell its shares in Corrections Corporation of America.
Okay, but the connection between Sodexo Alliance and Sodexo Marriott is not being terminated, correct?
Let me clarify that.
Please.
We're currently 48% owned by Sodexo Alliance, mm-hmm. And about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Sodexo Alliance made a proposal to our board of directors regarding the purchase of the remaining 52% from other shareholders.
So that means pending. Sodexo Alliance would take over Sodexo Marriott as a whole?
That's what that would mean, yes.
Okay. And I also have a question for Kevin. Just along the lines, you're giving us a lot of facts and figures and numbers and things like that. I'm just curious where all of this is coming from, if there's a place that we can all go take a look and see this for ourselves. Any student knows you can't just put a fact on a paper and not back it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, I wish that I could say that our website was the place where you could find all this stuff. Unfortunately, we've been busy organizing. We've done a lousy job with our website. We do have, I mean, I have with me tons of documents. The students have a lot of documents, and anybody who has questions on the particular facts and figures, we can find sort of citations for all of them. And I apologize. We're trying to get to a stage where we have all those facts and figures in one place, but we don't. There are a lot of good organizations that do, and if people come up, I can give you websites to research the topic.
Thank you.